And you go back and read Karl Marx and what he talked about 150 years ago is starting to happen today, and that is capitalism will cannibalize itself, and it's doing it because it's cannibalizing our entire ecosystem. Our ecosystem right now, as we speak, is subject to collapse. And when it comes, it's going to come hard and fast. And you're going to have, if they think that the migrant problem in Europe is a problem now, it's going to be a worldwide phenomenon. There's people in massive groups. Go see the movie. If no one saw the movie Mad Max, that's where we're headed.
Okay, we got to run, Robert. So that's the last word, Mad Max. And thank you so much, Robert Hunziker from Los Angeles. This is Paul Rowland, and this has been Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock, and it's time for Political Perspectives coming up first this morning on KBOO with host Doug McVeigh. He interviews writer, teacher, and filmmaker Lisa Ryan about Aaron Schwartz, Aaron's Edward Snowden, digital privacy, and electronic freedom. And then at 10 o'clock, we've got Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Doctors Without Borders calls for an international war crimes investigation into the U.S.-NATO bombing of a hospital in Afghanistan. At 11 o'clock on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen talks bees and beekeeping with Bill Catherall and Tim Wessels. It's the fourth annual beekeeping edition of The Dirtbag. If you have a bee-related question, call in and get it answered. And thank you so much, KBOO members, for your generous support in our December membership drive. It's not too late to become a member or increase your current membership and still have it doubled. It's a great idea. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And thanks in advance for doing that. Stay tuned now for Political Perspectives with Doug McVeigh and Lisa Ryan coming up soon.
KBOO Community Radio and Heartbeat Silent Sound Systems proudly presents Silent Nights 2015, a silent disco and silent auction benefit for KBOO, December 19th, 8 p.m. at Manifestation PDX. This very special silent disco features talented KBOO DJs and MCs. You'll have three channels of danceable jams to choose from, including bluegrass, the Grateful Dead, reggae, afrobeat, world music, hip-hop, funk and soul, electronic dance music, bhangra, and global bass music. There's something for everyone. We'll also feature a silent auction with art from local artists as well. Silent Nights will be on Saturday, December 19th from 8 p.m. to midnight at Manifestation PDX, 2020 Southeast Bush Street in Portland. For more information on the lineup and tickets and more, go to kboo.fm/silentnights2015. That's Silent Nights 2015, a benefit for our community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio. That's kboo.fm on the web, 90.7 FM on the radio dial. My name is Doug McVeigh. Aaron Swartz was a computer programmer and a freedom advocate. He founded a group called Demand Progress, which launched the campaign against the internet censorship bills, SOPA and PIPA. He was a frequent television commentator, author of numerous articles. He researched topics including the influence of big money on institutions, corruption. He worked with Tim Berners-Lee. He helped develop and popularize standards for sharing data on the web. He co-authored the RSS 1.0 specification, Real Simple Syndication. Brilliant guy, and he's no longer with us. My friend Lisa Rhine is the founder and director of the annual Aaron Swartz Day, which takes place November 7th and 8th. Lisa is a writer, is a musician. She is brilliant, the digital archivist and librarian webmaster for the Timothy Leary Archive. She was involved in, she's been on the web since there was a web, and she's my guest right now. Lisa, how are you doing this morning?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you. The quick thumbnail that I sketched of Aaron Swartz is inadequate. Could you please tell us about him?
Wow, I was thinking you did a pretty good job there, actually. Aaron was interested in the truth and fighting for justice and making the world a better place. And even I didn't realize how many different things he had going on until I've been researching him actually since his death to try to make sure to paint an appropriate portrait of his life as we move forward. Not too different from my work with Timothy Leary's life, to be quite honest, in the sense that I knew I had a certain amount that I already knew when I started. And then it's just a constant adventure and exploration of finding out more and more that he did. Aaron did a lot of things that we knew about on the web, the SOPA fight that he helped. And it was really interesting that he was able to orchestrate a lot of that, and he didn't have personal contact with a lot of the people that he was working very closely with. Micah Lee, who was at the EFF for a while and is now the technologist at The Intercept, and a co-founder of Freedom of the Press Foundation. When I interviewed him for my film, From Dead Drop to Secure Drop, that I'm sure we'll talk about later, I expected this whole story about how him and Aaron met however often and planned things out. And he said, no, actually, we never spoke to each other personally. It was all these, everyone sort of had their technological mission at that point. And a lot of it has been documented. And again, I'm going to be putting a lot of these pieces together on the website as I'm making the film. I'm just finding too much interesting information that doesn't pertain directly to my film per se, that I still want to tell everybody about right away, you know, kind of thing. And so luckily I have the website, and I'm actually going to start blogging on my personal blog too about it. Just to keep the things on the website very focused on the material that was covered in the event and the people involved sort of directly. And then a lot of it is my personal interpretations about it, what it meant to me, and that goes on to another tangent. So I've decided to separate some of that stuff out, a lot of how it affects my teaching. This is the first time that I'm actually talking to my students while something is going on, teaching them about something while it's happening. I teach an introduction to news class at San Francisco State in the Broadcast Electronic Communications Arts Department. And our focus is whistleblowers, comparing like Snowden to the Pentagon Papers and talking about WikiLeaks. James Goodale, who was one of the main legal counsel during the Pentagon Papers for the New York Times, put out a book called Fighting for the Press just about 2 years ago. And so completely due to his book, I was able to restructure my class with a First Amendment emphasis, comparing the the issues of today with WikiLeaks and Snowden and these modern whistleblowers to the Pentagon Papers and what happened then. And of course, unfortunately, what happened then is because Nixon was so corrupt and bugging everybody that the case got thrown out and Ellsberg was freed that way. There wasn't any legal precedent set in terms of protecting whistleblowers. And that's become one of the main goals of Aaron Swartz Day, is to inform the public more about whistleblowers and specifically why they do it, and that they're trying to make the world a better place. They're trying to help the general public when they do it. And these things get framed very strangely in terms of doing it for their own personal ego. You know, Ed Snowden is going to go to Hong Kong and release these documents and put his life on the line and all this so that he would get famous, is one of the kind of hilarious narratives that you see. And so that's another goal of my movie. Again, Aaron seemed to understand all this way back when. He killed himself before the Snowden revelations happened. That was January of 2013. Snowden happened in June of approximately late May or June of 2013. And so that's the other thing that's been so incredible as I'm doing this research, is that Aaron had already put a lot of the pieces together. He had already been working on this dead drop anonymous whistleblower upload system with Kevin Paulson from Wired. It was actually Kevin's idea. He contacted Aaron, but the two of them had this prototype done already. And again, the whole thing was inspired by WikiLeaks. That's something else that I'm just finding out. We're finding out more and more about how WikiLeaks sent Sarah Harrison basically to rescue Ed Snowden from Hong Kong, and that's what she did. At the same time, Snowden didn't feel completely comfortable with the WikiLeaks model, which was just sort of throwing the documents up there for people to look through them and find out, you know, what they contained and the risk of exposing someone was a risk that he didn't want to take. And so his whole point was to hand over the documents to reputable journalists that would just scour through them and make sure everything was okay before it was released. And that's why actually a very small percentage, last I checked, but that was a few months ago, something like 2% of the Snowden documents is all that has even been released yet. It takes a long time to really go through them. Several people going through things line by line, redacting anything that could possibly, anything to anyone's safety anywhere. And that's the model that SecureDrop, which is the modern version of what Aaron prototyped, that's where it comes in. So it provides an anonymous whistleblower submission system using Tor, the Tor browser. So it's just as easy as using Firefox or any browser when you just kind of install it and double-click on it and it works. And then you go to a special address that connects directly to, for instance, the Washington Post or Forbes or the New Yorker or the Guardian. Gawker has one. Daniel Ellsberg just released exposefacts.org. So there's an actual Daniel Ellsberg endorsed implementation if you feel like blowing the whistle direct to a whistleblower, and that will go right to the exposefacts.org people, and then they will figure out which journalist to get it to. So the idea is that you don't have to put your whole life on the line anymore. These whistleblower protections that Hillary Clinton talks about all the time. It's very upsetting that to hear someone who might be our next president talk about non-existent whistleblower protections every time she gets the chance. They don't exist. The Espionage Act doesn't let you present a defense. Let's be clear on that. And that's what Ellsberg came up against in his trial when it was going on. He wasn't allowed to tell the jury why he did it. So that's just that doesn't even make sense in terms of how our justice system is supposed to work and in terms of being able to present your defense to a judge and all that kind of stuff and a jury. So never mind all that. In the meantime, let's let technology help us. Let's provide a way that you can not hate yourself every day if you're going to work somewhere where they're doing something that you do not agree with. You did not sign up for that when you went to work for this organization, yet now you're supposed to keep quiet about something. And so you need to be careful, of course, that you're not uploading anything that can be traced directly back to you and things like that. There are some things online with pointers about that, and you should read them all before you do anything. But the idea is you could get the appropriate documents, upload them using SecureDrop to the news organization of your choice, or more than one of your choice, and then go back to work, go on with your life, continue to get your paycheck and feed your children, figure out how you're going to separate yourself, perhaps from this organization, in due time. But it doesn't put your life in this pressure cooker. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking whenever the bad thing is happening, and you sort of did what you could, you know? Really, in this day and age, people can't be expected to do any more than that. They shouldn't have to put their whole life on the line because the only other choice is going along with some organization's bad behavior because you signed a non-disclosure agreement when you joined the organization. You know, this came up with Ed Snowden in terms of did he violate some secret oath when he gave these secrets to the public? It turns out, no, he didn't even do that. We found out Neil deGrasse Tyson interviewed him, of all people. He broke format and on his Star Talk show did two like hour-long segments with Ed Snowden talking about all sorts of really important constitutional issues and human rights issues and all this stuff I had no idea about. Nobody had asked the right questions, I guess, to get this kind of information from him. And what was revealed was that he signed two agreements when he, at first when he was with the CIA and later on when he was a contractor for the NSA. And yes, the first one is a non-disclosure, a civil non-disclosure agreement, like many people sign when they work at any job. That did say to not disclose the information from the organization and things like that. But the other agreement was an oath to uphold the Constitution and to protect it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And so when you take this, oh, okay, let's weigh the civil non-disclosure agreement against the oath to protect the Constitution. Hopefully that isn't that hard of a decision. And that was the decision he made. And I didn't realize until then, you know, that was the one thing where it was always like, I didn't have a good answer for that. You know, why, oh, he broke his oath. No, he didn't break his oath. He didn't break his oath. He chose an oath to the Constitution over a non-disclosure agreement. And that's basically what we're asking, even though these people probably don't swear an oath to the Constitution when they got their job. But in a way, we all have an oath to the Constitution if you believe in democracy. In terms of doing what we can in our day-to-day lives to try to still have that mean something. So there's a reason why you and I are still able to speak freely. I'm learning more and more that not everyone has these options, especially when you just don't have time because you have three or four jobs and you're trying to feed your kids or you're trying to make your way through college. I don't even know how the college students do it these days. They have to pay so much more tuition and everything costs so much. So I have a lot of respect for anybody working their way through college. And so a lot of what I do is, and what I'm trying to do with this movie, trying to get the word out to people about these ideas, trying to do it in a simple, straightforward way that isn't going to take a lot of their time to understand. And because I think these are important to them. It's for those kids that they're working so hard to feed so that they aren't growing up in a more oppressive regime than we're already in. We've sort of got democracy in quotes right now where we know now because of the Ed Snowden revelations that we're all being surveilled. there are other safety reasons and things like that where we like the cameras here and we don't like the cameras there. The issues are complex, but one thing that is sure is if we don't fight, if we don't push back against whatever at least is obviously an intrusion, such as our personal correspondences, you know, you don't want to watch the entire population of the world as if they were under a criminal investigation. That's basically what's going on right now. They're collecting everything and looking through it later.
I want to ask you about Secure Drop and the film you're doing, but before we do, just for the benefit of listeners who may not know the story, Aaron committed suicide back in 2013, the beginning of 2013. He had been persecuted. He was being persecuted, rather, by the U.S. Attorney's Office out of Massachusetts. The Justice Department wanted to put him away for possibly up to 30 years. What did he do?
So what he actually did at the time, Aaron was a fellow at Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. Okay. He's on the MIT network, as he often is. And he was logging into JSTOR using a regular account. So the thing you should understand about the MIT network is it's a completely open network. Anybody that's on campus can use it, use the Wi-Fi. And JSTOR also has an agreement of allowing a certain amount of free access to journal articles when you're on the MIT network.
Right. It's just to clarify, JSTOR, Digital Library, it's just short for journal storage.
Right, right. JSTOR is a library full of academic journal articles. And this was an issue with Aaron as far as the paywall on these academic journal articles, okay? So basically what he was doing is, because I want to make this simpler, I don't want to make it too complicated, and there's no need to make it complicated. He was downloading journal articles from the JSTOR website faster than a human would be able to type and click through. He wrote a script so that it could happen in his absence. And then he decided that, you know, the wireless interface was a bottleneck because you could only download so much so fast over that. And arguably are hogging a little bandwidth or something maybe when you do that. So he went and he got an Ethernet cable and he plugged his laptop into a router in the Ethernet closet, okay, in the computer closet. That's what they're calling hacking into the network. Plugging in the Ethernet cable into the closet, okay? He was using his own computer. Another one of the charges was unauthorized use of an MIT computer. He didn't use anybody's computer but his own laptop. And then, of course, his hard drive filled up, so he went and got an external hard drive and plugged that into the laptop and was downloading articles onto the hard drive. And the only thing that was even halfway hacking was that when the account stopped him after and said, hey, you've exceeded whatever from your account because things are just happening too fast, he spoofed it. He created a new account. So that part is the only thing that could even be construed. You know, writing a script is not hacking. Doing things faster than they intended is not hacking. The only thing that is, and again, you know, this is all seen as, this is positive hacking, not negative hacking. This is just the hacking in the terms of doing, you know, using ingenuity to do something that you're doing anyway that isn't bad faster. Okay. And really what happened was they had some people that had just started working there. They had a new IT guy and new legal counsel. And they sort of freaked out and called the cops instead of just handling it internally. The whole thing, everyone's in agreement, should have been handled internally. MIT students and faculty, everybody, MIT is a known place for hacking and innovation, and it's usually heralded for such things. But in this case, it was just sort of bad timing for Aaron, and they called the cops. Now, Wyeka handed over to the Secret Service, we're only now finding out. There has been this relentless treatment of him by the government, and it was, as Jacob Applebaum said in his talk, and I highly recommend anyone interested in this listens to his talk, which is completely transcribed and everything on Aaron Swartz Day. There's a whole index of speakers and everything I just made the other day. And like he was saying, it's hard to believe that the government was being that relentless to him over a couple of Python scripts and some PDF files. So it looks like they might have thought that he had connections to WikiLeaks. Nobody else knows about anything. He certainly wasn't talking about it. And WikiLeaks made some tweets about him maybe being a source, which was very controversial. Why would they out a source just because somebody died? They were trying to draw attention to the fact that they thought that that might have been why the government went after him. Certainly this whole Secret Service file thing never made any sense. And the crazy thing about this, Kevin Polson, who worked with Aaron on the DeadDrop prototype that became SecureDrop, he has a court case, a FOIA case, against the Department of Homeland Security, who intervened when he tried to access Aaron's FBI and Secret Service files. So first the Department of Homeland Security stops the FOIA request from going through, basically. I'm totally oversimplifying it, but basically. And then MIT jumps in and says, wait a minute, you have to let us look at the documents before they go so we don't get embarrassed by anything that's happening. And the government buys it, lets MIT further redact anything before it's released to the public. Completely unprecedented. It has never happened before in like the history of FOIA. So we don't know what's going on with MIT and the government. We just know that more than we would like, and we need to get these. That was the other thing that Jacob called for, is complete transparency on Aaron's FBI and Secret Service files. If somebody's going to be embarrassed, let's just get it over with. Let's figure out what's going on. We can't just not do anything anymore. We need to understand what happened and what was done to Aaron.
So instead of paying $35 to get a copy of one of these articles from the journals, because journals charge out the wazoo for these things, instead of paying $35 for an article or paying a few hundred dollars for a subscription in order to have a personal copy of those, he basically just downloaded articles.
No. It wasn't for a personal anything. In fact, this is one of the mysteries, is actually we're not sure what he was going to do with them. We're pretty sure he wasn't going to give them away, as the government contended. Aaron would run software across large groups of data. He did a study with Stanford on the Westlaw database, which is a legal database of legal journal articles. And he was able to find connections between the funding of articles and sort of questionable legal research, the kind of thing that might make Exxon look good after an oil spill. The idea was that it wasn't until you had a large collection of articles like this that you could run software to make connections between them, who funded, who wrote, and cross-reference it with subject and figure things out. So the only clue that we sort of had to go on, but from a pretty reliable source, Carl Malamud, who worked on the PACER database liberation with Aaron, which is now available at public.resource.org, he said that Aaron was going to do research on looking for connections for climate change research, in terms of especially these companies that are kind of funding all this false research that's trying to put climate change into question. And that was all that we know. This wasn't Aaron. Aaron didn't put on his cape one day and decide that he was going to take his life into his hands and download journal articles off the MIT network. This was something that he did among many other projects he was working on. He didn't talk to anybody about it. He wasn't being secretive about it. He just, like, really, he wasn't thinking about it to the point where he was telling people about what he was doing. I think he was collecting the data. The way things work sometimes, you know, you come up with an idea and you do it, and then you get to it when you have time. He had a lot of other things on his plate when he was doing this, and we don't really know exactly what he was going to do. He wasn't going to set up a competing service selling the articles. the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto, which is actually a wonderful document that we are trying to bring more attention to. Not that it was this way it was sort of vilified by the government in Aaron's case. And it just talked about how knowledge shouldn't be behind a paywall. And there's the FASTR, F-A-S-T-R initiative that the EFF is working on. And a lot of the companies in charge of these journal articles are starting to come around doing things like, hey, let's have it behind a paywall for 6 months or a year or something and make your money and then give it back to the culture. Because, you know, as Cory Doctorow says in the Aaron Swartz movie, you know, the kid that's going to come up with the cure for the thing that's got your number, you never know where that's going to come from, who it's going to be, what part of the world. Already, there are a lot of places in the world. One of Aaron's projects, the Open Library Project, is now picking up again. It was his first project really after Creative Commons when he was 16 with the Internet Archive. And it has now become a lifeline of knowledge for all over the world, where people who simply would not have access to valuable information any other way can now download all sorts of books and important information via PDF. And that's what's really, that's what this is about, is we don't live in a world anymore where knowledge itself should only be for those who can afford it. It's not in our own best interests. We have a lot of big problems to deal with. We need everybody in the world learning as much as they can. And that model is just outdated. And again, you know, Aaron understood this a long time ago.
I find it frustrating occasionally because, as you know, I do research on various topics, including public health. And there's research from the feds, the CDC has been doing, which they're not necessarily publishing as CDC, but they'll do an article and their people will do an article that gets published in the New England Journal of Medicine or in some other prestigious journal, Nature, Science, but they're behind a paywall. So if you don't pay $35-40 to the magazine, you don't get a copy of this research that you, as a taxpayer, paid for, which is, right. Which is, I mean, it's utterly frustrating, but they are serious. They don't want to give over this information, even though there's, even if it's only for your personal, it's such a frustration. But I'll go on a rant, and this isn't my rant.
But you know, the point is that, yeah, just like you're saying, it's like paying for it twice. That's the important thing. That's the takeaway here. And that's why it's not fair. We already paid for it once. Anything connected with the CDC certainly is supposed to be all of the data from the whole data from research is supposed to be bundled up and uploaded to the CDC. And the idea that the cooked down versions, the really useful versions of this information, is still behind a paywall. Now, people are working on things much in the way that we have for Pacer now. We have this recap plugin that you can install in Firefox. And if you're downloading a legal document from the Pacer website, you can send it over to publicresource.org for the people's library, if you will. And there has been talk about doing this kind of thing with journal articles. And that way, at least, when one of us pays for it, we can put it in the public, put a copy in the public library. And so that's how we're able to fight back a little bit on this kind of stuff. And just however each person is making copies of whatever they have already paid for. And then certainly by then, it's their choice to make a copy and give it to the public, and we're trying to let more people know about those programs.
You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio. That's KBOO.FM on the web, 90.7 FM on the radio dial. I'm Doug McVeigh, and I'm speaking with Lisa Rhine. She is a co-founder of Aaron Swartz Day. She's a journalist and an advocate, and a very cool person. The One quick thing, and that is just for, so people know, PACER stands for Public Access to Court Electronic Records. It's a service that provides online access to U.S. appellate, district, and bankruptcy court records and documents nationwide. Sounds like a great system, and it sounds like something that ought to be available to anyone. Period. Is it PACER.gov? And unfortunately, it's a fee-based system. And if you want documents, you will pay quite a lot of money. And these are court records. These are public documents. But this electronic will make it so much easier for the public to have access. And now we'll charge them exorbitant fees so they'll be out of reach of most people. It's outrageous.
Just to be clear, it's the thing about PACER is, yeah, it's about 12 cents a page. It adds up faster than you would think. And you have to have a credit card. So already there's a lot of people that they just don't have the money. They can't have it, don't have a credit card. And so it's already separating, you know, access to the law. Aaron did something where he knew the libraries had a free program that they had implemented, and he worked on it with a friend to come up with the same kind of script, actually, that he ended up using for the JSTOR documents. And it allowed to download a lot of documents from the PACER system, and those were uploaded and are available at public.resource.org. That's where you can get those, and that's why we have access to those now.
public.resource.org. Sounds like an incredibly good resource. Let's talk about your movie. I want to find out about Secure Drop. What's the title?
It's called From Dead Drop to Secure Drop. Yeah, I'm really excited about the movie, and I have a Kickstarter campaign going on right now, and I really need help with, you know, getting enough money to do the editing, so I'm excited to talk about it. So the idea is this Secure Drop software that I started to talk about, and the idea is where did it come from? Who created it? And what's the history behind it? We knew that Aaron was involved. But I didn't know really who got the idea and how did it make its way after his death to the Freedom of the Press Foundation. So the Freedom of the Press Foundation is this incredible organization. It was co-founded by a number of incredible people: John Perry Barlow, Daniel Ellsberg, Ed Snowden is now on the board, Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, director of Citizen Four, John Cusack, the actor. And just a lot of interesting minds coming together. Trevor Tim, formerly of the EFF, and Rainey Reitman, who is still at the EFF. And they decided to start doing things to protect journalists. They were crowdfunding for WikiLeaks after our government shut down their ability to accept donations, which is sort of like, you know, U.S. government shutting down a nonprofit. Basically from public embarrassment from some of the cables they had released. Again, not the kind of thing that's supposed to happen in the United States, but there it was. So they started off doing that. They crowdfunded a transcript for the Chelsea Manning trial when the government made an announcement that there wasn't going to be a transcript. Sorry, we don't have the money for it, which is like, whoa, trial of the century and no money for a transcript. It just really was, you know, kind of a freaky situation. And, you know, no sooner had my brain just started reeling from this news when the Freedom of the Press announced that they were crowdfunding a transcript. That was my second sort of, who is this Freedom of the Press Foundation? What's going on with them? This is really cool kind of thing. So they found out, and this was what the movie deals with in terms of the timing, what happened before and after the Snowden revelations and things like that. But they heard about this Dead Drop project. And at the same time, Kevin Polson, who was the one who collaborated on Dead Drop with Aaron, was also wondering where it was going to go. It needed a new home. He had sort of made the prototype. He himself wasn't a programmer. It wasn't like anything he could continue to develop on his own. And this was something that everybody was in agreement that we needed. So it's a WikiLeaks that goes direct to news organizations. A combination of these two models that we have we had whistleblowers in the past. Everyone thinks about Watergate and how it was a whistleblower that we now know was the head of the FBI, was Deep Throat, Mark Felt. But at the time, it was just an anonymous whistleblower with a lot of good information. Woodward and Bernstein followed up on it. Luckily, it led straight to the President of the United States. Who would have thought? And that was possible in that world when you could still sort of send somebody a letter in the mail and it wasn't guaranteed that it was going to be picked up by the U.S. government. Now, journalists are being watched, and we know it. It's been in the New York Times, the Associated Press. It's acknowledged, but nothing has really been done about it. They were watching journalists even more than they're watching everybody else. But this puts sources into a much more dangerous position, because literally, they could send an email to a journalist about anything, much less blowing the whistle on something, and they could get in trouble from having that found out. So the idea is that since we can't in the past, journalists could go to jail if they wanted to protect their sources. But now they don't have that chance. The government will already know who has contacted them. So this is where SecureDrop comes in, with this anonymous whistleblower submission platform, so you could get information to journalists. So the idea, original idea of the movie, was just to follow the trail, talk about who created it and how it made its way to the Freedom of the Press Foundation. It's really expanded a bit into being a bit more than that in terms of the role of whistleblowers and why they do it, which is for the public good. And I was trying to make the argument without a concrete example until a week ago of how whistleblowing affects the common man. You know, I hate to say average people, because these people aren't really average. You know, nobody's average. I don't like that word. So I came up with the common man because I think it's sort of like, you know, everybody else, not the people that have a lot of money, not the people that are sort of start out more with everybody else, but the people that, you know, care about each other and work hard and like to think that they're a productive member of society and that there's still something to that, you know, and that's who the whistleblowers are trying to help when they find out that Company X is poisoning a town, or, you know, Company Y has done whatever, or, you know, especially within government, corruption within government is horrible, because these people are in charge. These people are supposed to be doing things for the public good, and then they misuse their role and authority, which is a whole other kind of nasty corruption when you're abusing your place of authority. And so last week we had a really great example of this, a concrete example. Someone used SecureDrop to upload a hack, we believe, of prison phone call data. And it showed a number of different things. It showed, first of all, that the company wasn't keeping their data very securely, if all very personal data, actual phone calls even, for a lot of these records that they had. And also they were recording a lot of privileged attorney inmate calls. And that actually gets tricky. I've been talking to the folks at prisonlegalnews.org, which is a great website for these kinds of issues. And it's actually very tricky, because the law, the Sixth Amendment violation that I was so quick to jump to and ask about, isn't as clear. It hasn't been broken necessarily just by it being recorded. A prosecutor would have to listen to that call and act on it, and then have it result in a longer sentence or something negative happening to the inmate as a result. That's what you would have to prove. And so the way that these systems are set up, the company can just say, oops, we didn't mean to record it, but look, it wasn't accessed by anybody anyway. No harm, no foul. And so, but it did draw attention to that, you know, that was happening. It also drew more attention to this company who's been involved in these kickbacks to the various government organizations that are awarding the contracts. So they're overcharging the prisoners and their families for their phone calls, collecting up the money and putting it back into the budgets of the various prisons and jails and everywhere. And so the prisons and jails say, oh, well, it's actually going for prisoners. It's going for abuse centers and uniforms and all these prison expenses. Well, why are the prisoners paying for their own expenses? We're the one, we put them in jail. This should be a public expense to feed them and put uniforms on them and things like that. So this upload to SecureDrop has drawn attention to all of these different problems, all of these different issues with the prison system. And, you know, they're putting so many people away now for so many nonviolent crimes. I bet you most people that are listening to this broadcast know someone in prison or knows someone that knows someone in prison. Almost everybody has a friend or family member that has been in contact with the prison or the jail system at some point or another. And this affects all of those people. This affects people if you're in jail for a week and you're trying to stay in touch with your wife, that is still, those exorbitant fees apply then. And it's just not right. So already I had this great example of how this whistleblowing can help the normal people in their normal lives and drawing attention to this kind of corruption that hopefully we can do something about once it's been, you know, once people are aware of it.
We're coming up close to the end of the hour. Again, this is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. I'm Doug McVeigh, and I'm speaking with Lisa Ryan, a journalist, co-founder of Aaron Swartz Day, and a filmmaker with a new movie project called From Dead Drop to Secure Drop. So give us some websites, and if you have any closing thoughts.
Right. Okay, so I just want to tell you, so as far as the movie goes, the idea is to, yeah, really get this idea out to people of about whistleblowers and why they do it. And one thing that was very important to me this last event was that I read a statement by Chelsea Manning, who is serving 35 years at Fort Leavenworth. And she released some very important documents through WikiLeaks about things that the Army was doing, questionable practices that she couldn't look the other way when she saw. And her statement talked about technology and what she called the human element. And she was, you know, even with SecureDrop, this is true. And this is what changed the focus of my movie a little bit and made it more about the people, or as much about the people, as the technology itself. So we're using encryption to protect these whistleblowers so that they can get information to a news organization. But it's also about helping the public to understand why whistleblowers do it, the good that comes from it, so that they themselves will be able to evaluate if they find themselves in that situation and weigh the pros and cons and decide if they might want to blow the whistle using this method. So I really appreciate everyone's support on the Kickstarter campaign. People laugh at, it's not really that much money. I'm just trying to get $20,000 to be able to pay for some of the editing costs and so that I can take a month or two to work on it. Really, I have a lot of things shot already, but I will be going to Berlin to interview two people from WikiLeaks, Jacob Applebaum and Sarah Harrison, just to get the WikiLeaks take on this kind of thing. And I have to go to Berlin to see them because they are in exile. They're self-imposed exile, but they would definitely be taken into custody probably if they tried to come into the United States or England simply because of their political actions. And again, not supposed to be the kind of thing that happens in a democracy, but that's where we are. So I'm a little nervous about going to Berlin. I got to tell you, I'm certainly not going to bring any equipment with me. And it's really weird to be in that position. I'm nobody. I'm just making a movie. But just being in contact with people sometimes now can, you know, put you on some list or have you, you know, treated differently. But I really want to get this story out to people again, so that the common man can figure this stuff out, whether they agree with me or don't agree with doing it. You may see my movie and decide this is something that you don't want to do, but at least you have the information to make that decision. And that's also the point of it too. I don't want anybody rushing into anything that they haven't thought through. There are still a lot of risks involved. The secure drop people are quick to say nothing is 100%, but it's as good as we have for now. And so far, so good. It seems to be doing its job at protecting identities.
Well, that sounds like a segue to me. So let's hear now that statement by Chelsea Manning, which was delivered at Aaron Swartz Day 2015.
And now, a few words from a very brave person who unfortunately can't be here in person or even remotely tonight. That person is Chelsea E. Manning, who is serving 35 years at the United States Disciplinary Barracks at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. Technically, she's eligible for parole in 2020. Like Aaron, Chelsea is a member of a generation of programmers that grew up using computers. Chelsea was born just about a year after Aaron, and she was programming at age 7, although she is quick to clarify that she really didn't know what she was doing until she was 9 or 10. She remembers the day she created her first web page in 1997, when she was 10, using HTML 3.0. She also remembers the launch of Creative Commons in 2002, when she was almost 15, and she was greatly influenced by Richard Stallman's book, Free as in Freedom. Chelsea Manning would be here tonight if she could, but hopefully someday she will be here in person with all of us in a huge celebration of the justice that hopefully she will one day be the recipient of. I will now read her statement. Hello, everyone. This is a statement for Aaron Swartz Day and International Hackathon 2015, entitled The Human Element. Hello, everyone. First, I'd like to apologize for the awkwardness of this written medium. I would love to speak in person, as well as attend and contribute to events like these, but certain circumstances are complicating my ability to travel and communicate in any fashion recognizable to most of us in the 21st century. In fact, seeing that this is a technology event, I'd like to talk about the incredible ubiquity and access that society now has to highly connected information technology devices. It seems to me, at least, that as we enter the era of ubiquitous computing, the so-called Internet of Things, with cell phones hugging against our hips, laptops and tablets in everyone's bag, and toasters that have the uncanny ability to sort our music libraries in the wrong way and have uncomfortable conversations with our grumpy selves in the morning, we have begun to blur the lines within our human society in unexpected and even exciting ways. Looking at the rapid advances in our social and political sphere in the information era, such as cultural progress queer and trans movements have started to make, the relationships between such things as gender and sexuality, between art and work, between gender and work, and between sexuality and art have blurred in incredible ways. Now there are elements and ideas which seem to implement the concept of transhumanism. And it's becoming normal for more and more people who anticipate, as well as fear, the economic, information, and technological singularity at the supposed end of our exponential graphs in our own lifetimes. But consider the paradox that technology has provided for us. We seem more diverse and open as a society, but isn't it also the case that we are more homogenous and insecure than we ever have been in the last century or so? You might try and tell me something like, well, today's tools provide us with the ability to be more independent from the control of our governments and corporations than ever before. But I ask, do they really? I don't think very many people in here are convinced that technology is a purely liberating tool, as we are now seeing that it can also be used to censor, to control, to monitor, to anticipate, to imprison, and sometimes even kill. I am arguing that we can be independent and liberated as a society even without advanced technology. It seems that some people today even find their independence by embracing the Luddite philosophy, ditching their cell phones for the weekends or avoiding the internet at certain times of the day or week. But I hope you don't think that you have to run to the hills of Montana and live in a cabin for years on end. That seems a little disproportionate, haha. Today, as is obvious in some of the headlines that we see online, we are in a constant technological arms race. And I think that it's important to realize that we are always only a single breakthrough away from making the methods of network obfuscation and encryption pointless or unusable. While I agree that it is unlikely, it certainly is well within the realm of possibility that we might wake up tomorrow morning, or, if we're really honest, tomorrow afternoon for some of us, and find out that some truly brilliant or devious mathematician or mathematicians have solved the Riemann hypothesis, throwing entire regions of our encryption arsenal into turmoil. Or we might wake up and find out that a 6, 8, or even 10 qubit near-perfect error correction has been built, effectively accomplishing the same. The point I'm trying to make here is that, and it is sometimes hard for those of us in the tech community to accept, that our technology can only take us so far on its own. Rather, it is the human element that is so important and unfortunately very easy to forget. Most of us are acutely aware, our software can be written to accomplish a task that, in the right hands, solves incredible problems, creates miracles, eliminates boundaries, and saves lives. Think about, for instance, the entertainment provided by streaming videos and video games, the real-time artificial intelligence applications that are used in automated cars, manufacturing plants, and medical equipment, or the so-called big data platforms being applied for internet search, marketing, political campaigning, and healthcare. Yet, that very same software, with a few minor tweaks, can, in the wrong hands, cause immense problems, create nightmares, raise insurmountable boundaries, and destroy and even end lives. Think about how the same technology used in streaming video, video games, real-time command and controls, and artificial intelligence can also be used in unmanned aircraft armed with missiles to wreak havoc on barely discernible people hundreds or thousands of miles away. Think about the statistical nudges in big data algorithms that create gender, racial, ethnic, gender identity, sexual orientation, religious, political, and other biases across large swaths of the online population. Also, think about the intensifying polarization and heavy focus on the precision targeting on swing voters in the political realm. Real people in real places in real time are affected, sometimes on an immense scale. Software is only a tool. Technology is only a toolbox. It's what we create our software for, and what we intend to use it for, and who we allow to use it, and how much that really count. I now believe that today's coders and engineers have an extra hat that we have to wear on top of the colorful spectrum of hats we already have, namely the technology ethicist and moralist hat. Whether we're amateurs or professionals, and despite whether we want to or not, it has now become another duty that we have. I only hope that the majority of us can figure out and fully understand what that is going to entail as we approach the edge of our graphs. In fact, human lives and the future of humanity may depend on it. Thank you for your time, everyone, and good luck in your endeavors. I would especially like to thank Lisa Ryan for her lovely letter last month inviting me, to speak before you all. It was an incredibly warm and heartfelt letter that made my day a little brighter. Good night, everyone. Chelsea E. Manning.
All right, that was our guest, Lisa Ryan, reading out a statement from Chelsea Manning, which she sent to Lisa for Aaron Swartz Day 2015. You can find more of that audio and video at aaronswartzday.org. That's AAronSWartzday.org. Videos and audio from Aaron Swartz Day 2015, 2014, and 2013 are all available at that website. Aaron Swartz Day is always November 7th and 8th. That brings us up to the end of the hour. The clock has beaten us once again. You're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Radio. That's KBOO.FM on the web, 90.7 FM on the radio dial. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh, and my guest is Lisa Ryan, the journalist, filmmaker, and electronic freedom advocate. Lisa, thank you so very much for all your work and all your time.
Thanks so much, Doug. Bye, everybody.
And stay tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up, it's Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia. Stephen Zunis is one of her guests today. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, there's an international investigation into the U.S. NATO bombing of a hospital in Afghanistan. And then we got the dirt bag. It's all about bees today. That's at 11 o'clock. And here we go with Air Cascadia. Thanks for tuning into KBOO today.